The warrant is there. Do you warrant?
You had something right in the beginning.
You mentioned something about Tyee.
Tyee, that Miller here was building those Tyee sets. This guy down here's got one. I mean, he don't part with it, but I'm going down and get some photographs of it.
I don't remember one of them, Warren.
Miller, that German.
I remember Miller, all right.
Yeah, Salmon Cannery Machine, yeah. Smith, is it?
Smith Cannery Machines Company.
Yeah, they built them.
Yeah.
Or he built them in their plant.
Did you ever hear the story on Miller? That he was the lieutenant captain of a German submarine later on.
He was running the station here.
Yeah.
But, I checked this out with Bob Palmer and Paul Hackett. And that was their trade name, was Tyee. Tyee was the Indian River.
What year was that?
About 1914.
14. That's about the time.
When Peterson was out here, he took them up and showed them where the old station was located over there in Magnolia Bluff.
I just got out here a little too late. I missed all that stuff. The East Coast don't interest me anymore. It hasn't for many years. Anything before 1912, I'm sunk. In 1914, I was in Portland. We were just about to move to Seattle, I think.
Well, Hackett had the whole story on Miller. He showed up on the East Coast as a Western Union operator, and he came to San Francisco. And Bob Palmer tells me that he went under the name of Miller there, he went under the name of Muller when he came here.
It was von Muller, was actually his name.
Yeah.
Germany.
Yeah. Well, I haven't the true name, but it's von something or other, and he was pretty high up in the command of the German army, and he was here for quite a while, and he was sending code messages out reporting ships out of Vancouver. See, it's because the British Empire was then at war with Germany. We were not. So they were reporting ships out of Vancouver to the German raiders in the Pacific to pick up. Well, they got ready to raid him here when they got wise to him, and he skipped out between daylight and dark. Took the radio equipment, and from the stories I hear, he showed up again down in Mexico
sometime. Well, one of my first employers, old Ralph Crowes, you remember Ralph Crowes Electric Company? You've heard of him anyway.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Well, I worked for him as a kid apprentice, electrical apprentice, in 1913, I guess. And he told me that he had actually gone out into the Ballard District here in Seattle, just a two-story dwelling, an old-fashioned house with an attic, and said he was shown where the equipment had been installed in this garret in Ballard out here, and he said you could see the marks where the key had been screwed to the table. There was a hole in the glass where the lead-in had gone through, and he swore up and down that was Mueller's hideout. Now, whether it was or not, I never did get any confirmation on that.
Well, he was supposed to have skipped out somewhere between daylight and dark and picked up out here in Puget Sound by German submarine. And they put him off down, so we understand.
Massive land or somewhere down there.
Massive land someplace where he probably set up operations again.
Well, Mexico was notorious for communicating with Germany in World War I. They had a lot of stations in there. German owned, of course.
But Paul Hackett over here, and Paul Hackett was an old timer around here that worked with Bill Dubilier when Bill was building these wireless telephones around here.
Is that the same Dubilier who made the condenser?
One of the same. And
he built the first wireless telephone. I heard it. It was on over here across the lake in Letchai Park. It sounded like somebody talking in a big rain barrel. Oh, no modulation, anything about it. It's all he can do to understand it. And he's got a replica of that rig yet, hasn't he?
That is the same rig.
It's the same rig.
Yeah. There was two of them built. Paul told me they built them down here in the Maritime Building.
Yeah.
And One of them went to Russia. They tried to get to interest the Russians in it. Then the whole thing blew up, I guess, for money, finances, and so forth. And Dubilier went someplace else on the thing. But we have a whole front page of the Times in 1910 with a picture of the boy wireless wonder and his telephone. But we have the old wireless telephone, and well, I took your picture, you and Hackett, down in my living room. We had it set down there. Well, Hackett's going to donate to that to the museum out here, which will be the place where it ought to go.
One of the first radio telephones.
But perhaps you noticed on the back of the old-timers, or was it the old-timers, Spark Gap Times, Smith down here has a picture DeForest Arc. This thing is almost identical to that. And it's interesting because this Victor Lauter, you call him Laughter, the print published that book, wrote an article to Modern Electrics from Victoria up here condemning Dubilier for stealing all his stuff. He says, if you don't believe all this, he tells a big long story. He says, you ask Paul Hackett, and he names two or three other people whose names are around. And I showed this to Paul, and he says, this is so. I'll show you some pictures of
it. Yeah, it's a telephone. He's talking to the flame.
Well, now, Bob says that there was a wireless concern on the Pacific coast that preceded the old DeForest station of PH in San Francisco. Their first installation, he said, was between Los Angeles and Avalon, and that was put in about 1903. And later they put in stations at San Francisco, and I had seen in an old article a picture of a single mast on top of Mount Tamalpais, and he said that was the start of a 20 kilowatt spark station that this company started to build for communication with the Hawaiian Islands, and they never finished it. They got partway through, and PH station was installed in the Palace Hotel, and they very soon afterwards went broke and got out of the picture. I wondered if you'd heard of that earlier company or not.
I wonder, was that by any chance, the American Wireless Telegraph Company? There's quite a chain of stations up in here. She lived in Bellingham, that's where she came from, and about four blocks from her house was one of their stations in Bellingham, Washington. And the kids used to, when she was just a kid, they'd go by and see all this blue flame and flashing sparks in the window. That was a station in Bellingham. Now, they had two or three others. I don't know just where. I think one was in Grays Harbor down here, Aberdeen or Hopium. Pacific Wireless Telegraph Company. They're listed in the old 1913 call book still.
Oh, they were still there at that?
They're still listed in the call book at any rate.
I've got a 1906 call book that we can check on.
Mm-hmm.
And a 1909.
He said they had one mast, as he remembered, of course, as a kid and a girl. She didn't have any interest in it, but she can recall a tall mast there in a residential area there.
Well, somewhere I've got a little article of a clip from an early magazine of a picture that had one mast with some wires that looked like in a residential area in San Francisco of an early. And it seems to me this article said something about this being one of the first or the first one in that area.
Of course, United had a big chain up through here. They were going to go across country, beat Western Union, you know.
Yeah.
They had one in Walla Walla. I've got a piece of the guy wire from that Walla Walla mast and pictures of the old Walla Walla station. But it's surprising what guy wire they use. That damn stuff is so that big around. It's just as well preserved as if it were new.
Well, they have that big mast over here, and I've got one of the insulators off of that.
Oh, yeah.
Palmer said he went up there in the brush one time, picked up a bunch of them, and he gave me one of them. They're a long wooden insulator, much like they use for supporting the streetcar trolley buses here.
Well, when I first hit out here, the first commercial I walked into, Marconi had just taken over the United at that
What
time.
Was the date of that?
That was 1912. I can't tell you just the month.
You don't know which month.
I could probably think.
Walker's got the information. Walker Williams.
Well, that, at that time, this might help tie it together. They had PA. That was up here. PH was Fresco. PA was Seattle. And PB was Ketchikan and so forth. PA was out at the University of Washington at that time.
I have a picture of that.
You have. That was United Wireless.
Yeah.
Then when Marconi took it, they moved it down to the Maritime Building. And that was PA for quite a while till it became KPA. Then their next move was up to the Smith Building, 21st floor of the Smith Building. Then that became NVL in World War One.
I think Walker's got those stories, and he and I recently visited A.H. Cox right over here in Leschi Park, and United took over his old station and operated from his place there.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I think he gave Walker the date that, they finally gave up. Marconi took it over.
Mm-hmm. We had one or two other commercial stations here that in Sparks. That 1915, a fellow named Ajax Todd and myself built for the city of Seattle, or it was the port of Seattle, and whatever they called it, the city, I guess, at that time, and put in the first KPE station on Pier 1 down here. That was in 1915, so they had three-letter calls. And I remember they gave us a little triangle way out at the end of the dock. The room was just triangular, actually triangular. It's in a broom closet. It was only 4 feet on one side and five on the other. We built the rotary gap using a phonograph record with brass studs through it and all that monkey business, you know. And we had a homemade loose coupler and a carburetor detector. I think we got $200 for the whole station after we worked about, I guess 6 or 8 months on it, trying to get the thing to go. And I've still got a picture of the antenna on the roof and also of the spiral helix and the first operator, Steven, sitting there pounding it out.
Was that on the Coleman dock?
No, it was on Pier 1.
Oh.
That's where the Port Commission used to have their offices at that time. And that was followed later when they began to see that the wireless was going to be something. Then they took it over as a city-owned business and bought a Marconi, no, RCA, I guess. It was a Marconi because the spark went out then. That is the rotary stuff. Yeah, about 19... Right after World War One, they bought a 1 kilowatt Marconi job and put in there. Of course, that expanded and expanded. They got big tube transmitters and all that, but that's gone now. But during the time that was going, we had competition here. In this KPE belonging to the port would take ship traffic to the steamship owners for a nickel a word, whereas Marconi was getting 10 cents. So all the ship traffic would come that way through KPE, and Marconi lose out on all that stuff. And Marconi refused to take position reports from then on because that was a free service, so KPE got stuck with them. Then here come some young red-headed guy, I forget his name now, and he got a smart idea. He was going to compete with both of them, and he opened up over in West Seattle on Alki Point over there with a rotary spark. This was long about 1921, around in there maybe. And it was KDOG was their call letter. They lasted about 3 months, and then they couldn't pay the rent anymore. I imagine he got about 3 messages a week from ships at sea. It just didn't go. But that has been our commercial picture around here, is those three stations.
They were, what now again?
First it was PH at the University, or PA, I should say, at the University of Washington. That was United Wireless. Then it moved to the Maritime Building. Still is PA, but under Marconi Company control.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, their call letters were changed a little later, made it KPA. And then about a year after the Smith Building was built. Do you remember when that was, Warren? That was 1915, I remember, I think. Yes, I was a kid. I was a freshman in high school, 1913. And I became a dropout in 1915. I haven't gone back since. And 1915. Yes, and I got one of my first jobs I got was helping hang the aerial on that damn pool thing from the clear up that 42-story tower on the Smith Building down to the Alaska Building. And I almost got messed up because they had the wire wrapped around the railing on that balcony and to snub it. And I was holding those loose ends, and the other guy at the Alaska Building putting a strain on with a winch. Right downtown in Seattle, geez, from a 42-story building to about a 15-story building, and trying to hold this damn thing, and she'd begin to pull me. And I saw, 42 stories to the street, not me, brother. I was only a kid, 16, 17 years old. I let go of it. I had nothing I could do. Jesus, the goddamn antenna wires, they came off of that tower, they went down, they landed on the trolley, there was fire flying about 17 different directions. I got fired that night when I came in. Brother, it was either me or bust the burner up.
And what was the KP?
KPA. Then when the Navy took over, that same station in the Smith Tower became NVL for the Navy.
NVL.
NV.
Oh, NVL.
NV.
I like this one better than I do.
And by then, of course, it became it was a 5-kilowatt quenched while it was KPA, and it still stayed 5-kilowatt quenched all
what
the time
frequency?
NVL had it.
60 cycle power?
It was 500 cycle quenched then.
Oh, I see, 500 cycle.
That's why Marconi moved out of the Maritime Building. They got this new 500 cycle gear, and they couldn't see putting it in the old beat-up Maritime Building, so they went to this brand new high-rise business,
And
moved in.
Building on the coast.
Yeah, I remember the first operator after the chief operator was a guy named Wilson, Peg Wilson. And Peg had two wooden legs. Both of them were wood. But they took him in the Navy and made him a chief when they made it NVL, Restricted Service Chief, because that's all he did was just stay as chief on that station. Got him a special permission for that. And we had another fellow up there. I went up to relieve him at midnight one night. I worked there to sort of fill him when they wanted time off or something. I'd take him his watch. Went up there and I relieved this Peg Johnson, this was. He was also a wooden-legged guy, but I didn't know it. But when he got all through with the watch, and he says, okay, she's all yours, kid, and he pulled up his sock and picked up a hammer and a tack. He says, damn, sock's coming down. Jesus, what was it? He says, wooden leg, you didn't know it. Yeah, I never forget those two peg-legged guys on the same station. Then the Wilson, this guy with the two peg legs, he'd been operator for United up here at Friday Harbor. That was PD. That's back in 1912. It was at Friday Harbor up in the, where is that? Whidbey Island, isn't it?
No, that's
San Juan Island. Yeah, PD. They had a string of them up in here. I was at PB at Ketchikan. That was after the Navy took over. That was the old rotary, just like Johnson had at KPH. We had a 5-kilowatt rotary down there. And we never could get any indication of antenna current in the antenna. It never would move the meter. And we'd raise hell with the Japanese coast station in Ketchikan on 600 meter.
Good night.
Never could get it to read.
Excuse me, I'm going to open another
1-kilowatt synchronous rotary for communication with PC or MPC or KPC down here at Astoria, a duplicate station. 25-kilowatt synchronous on about 3,800 meters, as I remember.
Was that 500 cycle, too?
No, that was a 240 cycle synchronous rotary. And she had 60,000 volt secondary on that transformer. Man, oh man. And this sink, it was probably the trickiest and the most dangerous thing that they could ever dream up. They had a 3-foot disc for the rotary gap disc on a 5-horsepower motor driving it. And on each, this was the rotary disc. Then they had 2 6-inch discs here for stationary studs, and they were motor driven, slowly geared down, so that they'd present a new surface to the studs all the time. And they were mounted on a rocker arm. You'd stand on this rocker arm with this damn thing going 1,800 revolutions, full of studs on the side, standing over, the spark discharging 60,000 volts across there. And you rock carefully there till you got her to fall into sync, and then back off and tighten the nut down below. Brother, if a fella ever fell in that thing, they had a bank of earthen jar condensers. Each condenser was 3 feet high and about 2 feet wide by a foot this way. Must have been, I think there was 48, four banks of 12 each, with great big brass straps across. That was their condenser. Their oscillation transformer was all of 8 or 10 feet in diameter, and it worked on a hinge on the wall. You'd swing the primary and the secondary that way. That was on the 25 kilowatt. See, we handled all the Alaska traffic. Everything for Alaska came through KPC at Astoria, up to KPB at Ketchikan. Then we distributed it to, what was it? KPC, I forget him, up at Juneau. Juneau and Sitka, they'd get it from there, and then they'd pass it on to Cordova and relay it. But man, oh man, we had 65 amps in the antenna on that 25 kilowatt rig. And the antenna was 20 wires between four 300-foot steel towers, and they were separated 400 feet between each tower. And it all come down this way into a rat tail L. And we had that same counterpoise that he described, that damned old welded wire laying on the bushes, all under the antenna, all through the berry bushes. You couldn't do anything with the ground, couldn't dig there, so just laid it on top. And I remember one time while we were there, it's the only real mechanical accident we had. This rotary disc, it going at 1800, came off the shaft. And this was a galvanized steel transmitter building. And as she come off, she rolled like this and cut a slot right through that galvanized and rolled right down the beach and sunk in about 12 feet of water. We were right on the beach.
This is at Astoria?
No, this is up Ketchikan.
Oh, it's Ketchikan?
Yeah, we had to get the station motorboat and go out there and fish for the damn wheel before we get back in commission. And we only had one accident, I mean the actual injury up there. The chief, a fellow named Clan, we had a rope just as you go in the door. They had looked like a kid's jumping rope, or the same kind of rope that you got on these ceiling lightning switches they used to have. And if you went in the transmitter house door, the trick was to pull that rope, and that tripped the oil switch, and there'd be no juice in the transmitter house. So the operator 60 feet away in the remote shack didn't throw the switch accidentally and start sending while you're in there. And Clan forgot to throw that. And Tommy Eastman was the operator, and the ship called him, or Astoria called him. And he kicked in the 25 kilowatt rotary and hit the key. And Clan was tightening the clamp on the top of one of the condensers in the primary circuit. Oh, that poor guy. The goo ran out of his ears. He just puffed up. He was something terrible. Of course, he was knocked out completely. And we got a car out from town. We got a half-cracked ambulance there at that time. Wasn't much in the way of cars, and got him down. And then the Navy sent a destroyer up and picked him up and took him to Naval Hospital. But they had to discharge him. It knocked his brains, apparently, just cooked him, because he just went all to pieces mentally. And finally, he did manage a little chicken farm down here in Kent, but he had to retire. Geez, imagine getting a hold of that 60,000-volt thing like that, with a bare wrench and bare hands, and then the... Of course, it's not Eastman's fault. He didn't have any warning.
Yeah.
Now, that's the only accident we had there.
I must make a correction on that A.H. Cox. That was not United Wireless. That was Federal that came up and put in.
Oh, yeah.
And they operated there at Lamont 1912. They tried to put an arc in there at Cox's place. We came right by it today along Lake Washington there.
Is that before they built the lead station in Oregon there near Portland?
Well, they discontinued this and was handling everything out of Portland and sent it up by landline on the postal wires.
I remember visiting that Lentz station once as a kid, 1912, in Lentz, Oregon. That was a Federal arc.
I was considering, perhaps I will take that paper.
Well, that's to my notion, is a very interesting tape, and as accurate as I could remember. I think Bob Palmer's in a better position. He just keeps his fingers on every date. I wrote a little item once. Oh, what's this guy's name back in Rochester, New York, in there?
Oh, you mean Bruce Kelly?
Bruce Kelly, yeah. His little paper, you know.
Yeah.
I give him a little item one time about something I'd used up in Jew Allen, Alaska, the gold mine. Well, that's Jew Allen, J-U-A-L-I-N, Jew Allen. But Bruce, and putting his stuff through, it looked like Julian to him, so he put it to Julian last. He gets a letter from Bob Palmer. You better correct that. That's wrong. Howard was right. It was because he was up there. I was operator there for a while. So he called him on it right away. That was an old United station, too, at a gold mine, a private deal. I don't know how United operated, whether they sold the gear to this gold mining company or just how it was, but when I arrived there, it still had the Leyden jars in the great big mahogany rack, copper-plated Leyden jars, a straight spark gap and helix, the gap inside the helix.
Oh.
And it was 5-kilowatt deal with the great big coffin. They had an oil break key on the table where the contacts went down the tank of oil and broke down.
I've seen that.
We didn't have any oil up there, transformer oil, so I used water in it. I'd send until the steam came out of the thing, and then I'd have to quit sending for a while. Of course, you'd just cook it, you know.
Yeah.
But we had communication with Juno, 60 miles, with 5 kilowatts, an 1,800-foot long antenna. Yeah, 1,800 feet. We worked on 2,200 meters.
2,200?
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize they had sparks up on those.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the Ketchikan was 3,800 meters.
3,800.
Uh-huh, plus our 600 shipboard stuff.
Yeah.
But Jew Allen, I had a Marconi 101 tuner.
Fred set up his microwave and couldn't find where we were located. And there was fog and we couldn't get any lights for light flashing. So we got some old tires and piled them up and burned them. And I called this guy on the phone and somebody overheard us. And I told him, I said, if you see that smoke up there, that's right where we are. So we orient this dish antenna. So the word got out that the microwave had failed. We'd given up and gone back to smoke signals. This was, we were setting up this back 1952. A local pickup over there in Spokane for the wrestling matches, and oh, we had a horrible time. We had to use a repeat point to get up over the hill with this thing, and the weather was terrible. This thing, the boss come up there, and I asked him, what are we in this kind of business for? What are we doing transmitting this kind of? He says, we're in the business of transmitting intelligence, whatever it is. And I was looking at the pictures of these two wrestling guys, and I wondered what he meant by intelligence.
See, I understand. It seems to me I read somewhere that you people are kind of giving up this microwave and going back to burying cables on account of vandalism. I read that somewhere.
I don't know. We got a lot of stuff on the drawing board for some microwaves. I've been out this week looking at some sites.
I think this was an Eastern paper or magazine that I saw.
We're putting in lots of cable. There's research work going on in some real...
Do you have much in the way of vandalism?
Oh, not too much, I guess.
We never did with the CAA stuff, very little.
Well, you know, about a year ago, or possibly a year and a half ago, there were two stations over in Utah put out of business simultaneously.
Yeah, I know. Our worst thing is hunters. They can't find any deer to shoot at, and they go shooting at anything else they can see.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Howard, what became of all this old United gear from the many stations that were up here and also in Alaska?
You know, there's a peculiar thing, and it's unfortunate that, well, I, for one, not only me, but all of us who are interested in historical stuff, we missed the boat. Down here on Jackson Street, it's a 6-story building, a concrete building, stucco building, that was built for or by United Wireless Telegraph Company as a factory, way back when, 1908, somewhere in there. And when they went belly up, Marconi abandoned the idea of using that at all. They didn't want a factory here in the first place, so they just let it go. They didn't take it over. And that thing was full of helixes and every other fool thing. You can think of all the old United Wireless gear. Because I'd gone down there and visited an operator that I knew, who later worked for Kilburn and Clark in their shops when I did. He had been an employee in the factory, and he didn't get his last week's pay, which none of them did. United just went flat. So this was Earl Ferguson was his name. And Earl took a 1/4-kilowatt, what they call cargo ship transmitter, transformer. It was a closed core deal, which was unusual for United.
Yeah.
But the little 1/4-kilowatt was closed. He took that and a helix and a Type D tuner. And I forget, I think there was, Type D tuner. I don't remember what else. And he said he still had that stuff after we'd gone out and looked at the old factory and couldn't get in. He says, I still got some if you want to see it. And so I got a wild hair. I says, how much will you sell it to me for? Well, he says, I'll be glad to sell it. That'll give me my week's pay. Well, I said, well, how much is that going to amount to? $16 is what he was getting in the plant. So I got that transformer and that Helix with a spark gap in the middle and the Type D tuner for $16. But I think if a little pressure had been put on, if we'd been older then and more savvy on this stuff, we could have put some pressure somewhere and got a lot of that stuff out of there. Well, that since was bought by the Yankee Maple Syrup Company, and they had it for a number of years. And one day I got a wild hair and went down there and talked to the manager there. And he says, well, we don't remember when we came in here. It was all cleaned out. It wasn't clean, but he said everything was gone from it. And he said in cleaning the building, there might have been some old copper tubing coils and things. He probably meant helices.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. He said it was worthless to us, and we just discarded it, threw it out, let the trash haul it away. But he said, you're welcome to take a look in our cellar down here. Well, they had a sub-basement that went up under the sidewalk, just dirt excavation there. And I crawled up in there and looked, and I didn't find a vestige of anything. Just wasn't anything there. And now it's since become the Howard Poultry Company, a chicken plucking outfit. Are they still there?
The building was up for sale last year. They've repainted it now, and it's whether it's occupied right now or not, I don't know.
Well, Howard Poultry's the last one I know of. And I also went down and asked them by any chance if they found anything between the walls or anywhere, but no, there wasn't a chance.
I have the pictures of it. We went out and talked to Nels O. Nelson, and he came here from Chicago around 1904. Back in Chicago, he had been manufacturing X-ray equipment. He came out here and set up a factory, and then when United came and wanted to set a factory so that they could supply ships on this coast, they bought him out because he had all the machinery for building this kind. And his son has all the papers and everything. There's a whole inventory of all the test equipment. They made him superintendent. His son had pictures. Walker and I have got copies of those pictures now. And I have serial number 2 of the old anchor gap. It's S2. The S was the spoke, or the Seattle. This is the second one built in Seattle. We have the pictures of all these pieces that Nels O. Nelson had built. He designed and they built them there in that shop. And this anchor gap is in one of those pictures.
Yeah, that was that hard rubber ring with the three
terminals
in it. I'll tell you a little funny one about this United Wireless out here. Yeah, I guess you missed it. Thanks. There used to be a fellow working for William O. McKay Company. That's a big Ford agency here. And he was just a car salesman there. But he was the first United Wireless operator to come out here when United started to establish their West Coast setup. Well, he and another fella came out, and they went to Astoria to set up the first station. That was the one scheduled. But the equipment hadn't arrived. They had nothing to do but play around at taverns, whatever they did, I don't know. For about 3 weeks, then the equipment arrived. But they had no mass. They were supposed to be shipped from New Orleans. And they finally got here by sailing ship. They came up after 3 or 4 months. And it seems like they bought these down in, say, Louisiana, somewhere down in there, and had them all stripped, these big, tall trees, 200 feet. Where they got them down there, I don't know. They must have had to splice them. But they shipped them all the way up here, when surrounded by it, as he tells the story. He says, we were surrounded with 200- and 300-foot firs all around us there. We could have cut one down and had the station on the air in a couple of weeks. But he said, we stayed there for 3 or 4 months, just waiting for those two damn poles to come all the way from New Orleans. They just weren't familiar with the West, what we had out here, you know. I don't know whatever happened to him. He's disappeared. He and the... And he's, I can't recall it. I've got it written in a call book. I wonder if I get that call book here. Or that was his partner, one or the other. But his partner became a member of the Oregon State Legislature. He played politics and then on the Equit Wireless. More money in politics, I guess. IRE proceedings at one time.
Okay.
A little thicker now. Property of P.W. Welch. Yeah, that was him. Pete Welch. That's Wireless Telegraph Stations of the World, 1910. And he used... Yeah, that was of... This was the whole call book of the world. All the wireless telegraph stations in the world.
Does that have Welch's name on it? Or Welch?
Welch. This is P.W. Welch, wireless operator. And to... Oh, he's written in Spanish here. Wireless operator, El Telegrafía Sin Hilos, Telegrafistos, or some such thing. There's his own call book, the stations that he worked. United Fruit Company's Wireless Service, Ships and Stations. There's the Ellis, Preston, Cartago, all their ships. Here's their stations, New Orleans and Zappa, UZ. Where the hell is that? Burwood, Southwest Passage. This is corrected to September 1st, 1909, this book. And he'd cut it all up here and made his own indexing on the thing. And there are a lot of two-letter calls in here, you see.
Mm-hmm.
M2, N-A, N-C, N-D.
How far back do those call books go that you have, Howard? Any well, 1904?
This is 1909.
I think 1908 is the first one.
I think so, because we didn't have any law, actually, in 1912, but these came out as a result of the Wireless Telegraph Act, rather than the radio law of 1912. There was an act before that, a shipboard. Ship Safety Act or something, and I think a few books were put out then.
I have one that's an early law book, call book as I know of, and it's a 1906, and that was published on the, printed on the battleship Maine, and it had belonged to D. Ford Greaves.
Oh, yeah.
And that's about the earliest call book I know of.
Yeah, these are the only ones I have managed to snag onto. The Old Timers Club have made replica pages of these, you know, they sell
yes.
that.
Well, Howard, could we take a quick look at your station before we take off?
I forget I got a station. I'm still in KPH, KPA, whatever.
You have a schedule?
No, not until 6 o'clock.
No TR reports,
No.